So I'd like to tell you today about work that I've been doing using first principle simulations to study supercooled liquids and glasses. This work that I'll tell you about is primarily done with my former student Ganesh. And here's an outline for the talk. I'll begin by telling you what first principles calculations are and why they might be useful. And then I'll show two particular examples. One is what can be learned on sort of practical matters about formation and properties of metallic glass. And then another study of what can be learned about the postulated liquid-liquid phase transition in supercooled liquid silicon. So let's begin by discussing what first principles simulations are. When I say first principles simulations, I am referring generally to a set of methods known as quantum chemistry. But I'll be working exclusively with the particular implementation, which is known as density functional theory. And actually, it's very suitable to be speaking on this subject here in Cohn Hall because of the very crucial contributions of Walter Cohn to the subject. So just to get you in the density functional frame of mind, I've shown you a subatomic level picture of face-centered cubic aluminum. And so you should think of the aluminum atoms as containing an ionic core, which has the nucleus and some inner shell electrons, and then some kind of freely floating valence shell electrons that are only weakly bound to the aluminum as an isolated atom. And when the aluminum atoms come together, the essence of metallic cohesion is related to the delocalization of the electrons, the reduction in kinetic energy of the electrons when they can be stripped off their individual atoms and float freely through space. So that's the essence of metallic cohesion and the basic process that we're going to be dealing with. All of what I do will be done within the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, where we treat the atomic nuclei as heavy objects obeying laws of classical mechanics. So for molecular dynamics, we'll use Newton's laws of motion. But the electrons, with their low mass, have to be treated quantum mechanically. And so we need to figure out what their wave function is. Of course, we know that the wave function obeys the Schrödinger equation. H psi is E psi. And actually, what we really want to know is E, because E will then be the energy of the structure under study. And if we look at gradients of E with respect to ionic positions, those will be the forces on the ions. So E is what we are going to be mainly interested in for my purposes. An important point about the wave function is that it's an n-body wave function. It's one complex-valued function that is simultaneously a function of n different electron positions, where n is the number of electrons in the system under study. So many-body quantum mechanics is a difficult problem. And so this is where we owe our great debt to Walter Cohn for showing us how to deal with the many-body problem in an effective manner. And in particular, Cohn and Sham show that there's an exact transformation of the many-body quantum mechanics problem to a set of coupled single-body quantum mechanics problems. So here you see a little miniature Schrödinger equation acting on a single particle wave function, lowercase psi, which is a function only of a single spatial variable. The cost of doing this, though, is that the potential energy that goes into the real Hamiltonian, that just contains the electron-ion interaction and the electron-electron interactions. Those are Coulomb potentials, and we know their form very precisely. Whereas in this single electron problem, we have an effective potential that we need to say a little bit more about. So the first thing is that this effective potential must include those contributions to the true potential. So for example, it will have to include the electron-ion interaction and electron-electron interactions. And the electron-electron interactions, of course, are going to depend on the position not only of the one electron immediately under study, but all the other electrons as well. And you can, in fact, demonstrate as Hohenberg and Cohn did, that this effective potential must be some sort of functional of rho of r, where rho of r is the complete global density of electrons. But it's not only true potential energies that go into this effective potential. There are additional contributions known as exchange and correlation. And those are also included, and they are also functionals of the global electron density. The only problem is that we don't know what those functionals are. We don't know, well, we do actually know how to write the exchange down exactly, but we don't know how to treat correlations exactly. So the main approximation will be how we represent this V effective of rho. Another detail is, what is rho? Well, within this coupled one body set of equations, the global electron density rho of r is just the sum over all the occupied single electron orbitals of psi squared, the single electron probability density. And so the governing equation for the single electron wave function itself depends on the set of all the single electron wave functions. That's where the coupling of these many one body problems comes in. And
Mike,
yes.
So with respect to these other terms, the correlation, I understand electron-electron correlation, so on. But what is the exchange?
Well, the exchange is the requirement that the many-body wave function psi n should be anti-symmetric under the interchange of any pair of coordinates. And that feature has to be built in, and it ends up telling you something about this effective potential. Okay, so so the really crucial approximation then is how we will treat this effective potential. And there's a famous local density approximation, LDA, which is often made. And then there are a variety of enhancements to the local density approximation. And all of the work that I'll tell you about is done in the generalized gradient approximation, where the effective potential depends not only on the local density, but also the gradient of the local density. Okay, now before I leave this slide, I'm about to start telling you why we would use density functional theory to study supercooled liquids and metallic glass. But before I do that, I might first tell you why not. And why not is that these are extremely expensive calculations. They consume a lot of computation time. And they are effectively limited to small systems. Depending on the particular atoms involved, you might be able to do 200 or 300 atoms at most. And because they're computationally so expensive, if you're doing molecular dynamics, you can only afford a few molecular dynamic steps that will limit you to time scales of order tens of picoseconds. So certainly if you're interested in scaling behavior where you need to go to limits of large systems and long times, these methods would not be viable. And also if you're interested in universal behavior, these methods would be a complete waste of time because by its definition, universal behavior should be independent of the precise atomistic details, the precise chemical specific chemical properties of the system under study. And the time spent using these first principles method. That's time spent trying to get those fine details right, but the universal properties are independent of the fine details, and so that would be time wasted if you're interested in universal properties. So now let's look at a series of very specific investigations of particular elements and compounds and what we can learn from those. So the first thing that I like to do with the first principles calculations is take a look at phase stability. And that is, I want to know, well, what are the stable crystal structures that could form in this compound? So let's take a look at iron boron. I hope this isn't too low for you to see down on the bottom here. In case it is, let me tell you that the horizontal axis is atomic percent boron, and so it ranges from 0, which means pure elemental iron, to 100% boron, pure elemental boron. And then the vertical axis is temperature, and every point in this composition temperature plane will have certain stable phases. So for example, at 50-50 composition, you get pure iron boron. At a 2-to-1 composition, you get crystalline iron 2 boron. In between, if you were at a composition here, you would get some mixture of the iron boron phase and the iron 2 boron phase, and so on. So that's what these phase diagrams show. And if you're interested in the formation of metallic glass, each of these phases that appear in the phase diagram, these are danger signals. They're saying that at this composition, the system likes to crystallize, and probably the best glass formation will occur where these crystal phases are not. So one of the questions you might like to ask is, has this experimental phase diagram, in fact, found all the stable crystalline phases? And in my experience, these diagrams are something of the order of 90% correct. And so I worked very hard to find an exception for this case, and I'll show you what I found. Yeah?
Can we see the phase diagram once?
Yes.
So this Fe2B.
Yes.
Going from Fe2B into this FeB. Is yes. there a structural change also happening?
No. So these are what are called line compounds. They exist only at a specific composition. And so if I were at a composition, say, right here, the system would phase separate into primarily the crystal of composition Fe2B with a small trace of the crystal of composition FeB so as to properly balance out the total number of atoms of every species.
Yeah, but the structure is the same in these?
No. Oh, no, no. The structures are different. Yeah. And on the next slide, I can actually tell you what those structures are. If I take a peek. So this structure labeled 19 is boron iron 2. It's the structure whose Pearson symbol is Ti12. That means tetragonal, body-centered, I means body-centered, with a 12-atom unit cell. Number 23 is 50-50 iron boron. That's orthorhombic, primitive orthorhombic, with an 8-atom unit cell. So they are different crystal structures. And one point I forgot to mention over here is that iron boron is one of the classic binary metallic glass formers. And one of the reasons it's such a good glass former, well, it's not that good a glass former, but one reason that it forms glass at all is because of this deep eutectic, which allows you to deeply cool in the equilibrium liquid before you need to quench down to the solid state. So you don't need to quench that far to go from the eutectic temperature down to the glass transition temperature. And this eutectic is at about 17% in between pure iron and iron 2 boron. Now, using the first principles calculation, I've calculated the enthalpy of formation of all the known crystal structures and many hypothetical crystal structures. So the known crystal structures are pure elemental iron, iron 2 boron, iron boron, and pure elemental boron. Actually, there's a whole other story that I could tell about pure elemental boron, but it's not a glass-related story, even though it's a beautiful story. So I won't tell it. So this is then a plot of the enthalpy of formation of various different known compounds and hypothetical compounds. The hypothetical compounds are shown with the squares, and the known ones are shown with the heavy circles. And agreement between calculation and the phase diagram at low temperature would say that all of the known compounds, that is to say, all of the heavy black circles, they should lie on the convex hull of this plot of enthalpy versus composition. And everything that is not a known compound should lie above the convex hull. In fact, there are a variety of metastable phases known in this compound. So these ones, number 6, number 11, and number 12. And number 24, those are all known metastable phases, and they lie just slightly above the convex hull where you would wish them to be. And then the various hypothetical compounds, let's choose a particular example, let's say number 20. That one was taken from a carbon-chromium system, which is chemically a little bit analogous to boron iron. As you would wish, it lies well above the convex hull. So in fact, we find perfect agreement between low temperature experiment and first principles calculation in this case. Yes?
So for this particular questions that you're asking,
yes,
what is the kind of resolution you need in order to answer, and what's
yes,
to be the
That second part of the question is a very difficult part. So this is electron volt per atom, and you see that these energy differences are typically of the order of, say, 1/100th of an electron volt per atom. The calculations that I do, I aim for a precision of 1/1000th of an electron volt, 1 milli-electron volt per atom. But that's the sort of the internal consistency of the numbers that are calculated. What is the accuracy of it? That's that's a really important deep question that nobody knows the answer to, and many people wish they did. But you can maybe get some insight into it by looking to see, we are properly reproducing energy differences that are at, say, the 1/100th of an electron volt per atom level, right? The energy difference between the metastable phase and the convex hull, we're seeing real effects that are at the level of 0.01 eV per atom.
For some classes of materials, you can make comparisons with more precise quantum chemistry calculations.
Many of the most precise quantum chemistry methods actually are not applicable to condensed matter. They work well for molecules in isolation, but they use methods that simply don't converge properly when you try to extend them through infinite space. That's one big drawback. But there are many different enhanced density functionals that include greater degrees of realism that you can use to get some insight into how accurate the answers are. I've already said that these first principles methods will not yield universal insight. And in fact, the answer to the question you asked has no universal answer. Yeah, Takeshi.
For instance, if you look at the energy of number 5 glass,
yes,
that's pretty high.
That's pretty high. Yeah.
That's probably because of lack of relaxation in the system.
It may be because of the rapid time scale of the quench. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you can compare this to, say, number 6.
Yes.
By experimentally looking at the delta H during crystallization.
Yeah.
So if you compare to experimental data, how big that is this
Yeah,
difference?
That's a great idea. I haven't done it.
Okay.
Excellent suggestion. Of course, I can't do that experiment. So I need to get hold of that and do it. And I'm glad that you mentioned item number 6, because that's something in particular I want to talk about. It's known as metastable state in iron boron. It's a stable crystal structure in carbon chromium. And it's a face-centered cubic structure with 116 atoms per cell. Here's a look at it.
But before you go on, just
yes.
We could go back. There was one other point that,
uh-huh.
that's important, and we sort of acknowledged it, but skipped over it
yes.
a little bit. And that is, your calculations, I think, are typically at 0 Kelvin.
And so what I'm describing here is only at 0 Kelvin.
Yeah, so if you look at 2 and 3, those are high temperature phases, and you can see how big the difference is. And
that's correct.
Also, it was a high temperature metastable phase. So it's important to keep those sorts of things in mind
yeah.
as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you can do certain things at finite temperatures with the first principles, but I'll show you, for example, MD simulation later on.
Even at this level, you can calculate the vibration.
Yeah, so one way to try to extend this to finite temperature, the first thing you would do is look at the vibrational spectrum and use that to get a vibrational free energy. In the case of boron, it turns out that there's intrinsic disorder in the form of partially occupied sites. And so there's a very important sort of discrete configurational entropy. So you can learn about finite temperature stability and temperature-driven phase transformations by such methods. So this particular metastable state, it's almost at the same composition as people favor for the metallic glass, and it is one of the chief competitors to the metallic glass, so you need to quench sufficiently rapidly that you avoid getting falling into that metastable structure. Now I'd like to tell you about molecular dynamic simulations done using these first principles methods. So I mentioned that given the energy eigenvalue of the Schrödinger equation, you can take its gradients with respect to ionic position, and those are the forces. And then with the forces, you can integrate Newton's equations of motion to carry out molecular dynamics. Here is a collection of several molecular dynamics runs done at different temperatures.
This is not
Kaplan-Meier. This is, I should mention, by the way, that I'm using somebody else's first principles code. I'm using the program known as VASP, also the Vienna program, it's known as. One of the details of this program is that every molecular dynamic step, it reaches complete electronic self-consistency, unlike the famous Carr-Parinello method that reaches approximate self-consistency every step. I won't argue that one is better than the other. The Carr-Parinello can be faster, but then it's not quite as accurate, not quite as precise. So this is done using VASP, and what you see here is a trace of energy as a function of time for runs done at many different temperatures. This is an NVT ensemble. So we're holding the volume and temperature constant and letting the energy fluctuate. And of course, the energy does fluctuate. So at a given temperature, sometimes the energy is high, sometimes it's low. This right here is actually a system of 200 silicon atoms. But for the application I'm going to make shortly, it will have been done for 100 atoms of a multi-component metallic glass. Okay, so
those are small systems.
They're small systems, absolutely. And the time requirements scale like the third power of the system size. So, you know, classical MD is an order n method, and this is an order n cubed, which is why we are effectively restricted to small systems. So I'd like to make a point, though, about these energy fluctuations. So if you consider a particular configuration, that configuration could have occurred in the equilibrium ensemble at any temperature. I mean, if we take, say, this one right here, this configuration with this energy actually occurred in this particular run at its own temperature. But the same configuration could perfectly well have occurred in one of the runs at, say, an adjoining temperature. It just would have occurred with a lower probability in that at that temperature. And in the spirit that that every configuration is a viable element of the ensemble at every temperature, we can take the configuration obtained at one temperature and enter it into our ensemble of structures at any other temperature that we please. And indeed, we can take a pair of runs, initially at temperatures T1 and T2, whose initial energies are E1 and E2, and we can take those two configurations and we can swap them between the two temperatures. And if we carry out that swap with the appropriate probability, this probability right here, if we carry out the swap with that probability, in fact, we will not have altered in any respect the equilibrium probability distributions by making the swap. And so this is a method known as tempering or replica exchange molecular dynamics, and it has many advantages. One is that it's possible for a system to, you know, start at one temperature and go up to another temperature, and you know, systems can go up and down in temperature, and as they go up in temperature, a particular trajectory can sometimes get over an energy barrier at the high temperature that it was unable to cross at the low temperature. So each individual trajectory is able to diffuse more efficiently, perhaps, using this method. And in addition, we get you know, many fresh configurations coming at every particular temperature, so we again increase the configurational diversity of our ensemble at every temperature by this method. And there's another nice advantage to using this tempering method, which is we will have accumulated data at a great many different temperatures, and among the data we've accumulated are energy histograms. So up here, for example, is an energy histogram that shows what the distribution of energies was at a high temperature of 1382 Kelvin. Down here is a histogram that shows the distribution of energies at 982 Kelvin, and we have a great many histograms at different temperatures, each one overlapping with the other. And that allows us to implement something called multiple histogram analysis. And here is the essence of the multiple histogram method. So at any particular temperature T, there's going to be a histogram that says how often each energy occurs at that temperature. And we know from the Boltzmann distribution that the histogram as a function of energy contains two factors. One factor is the density of states, the number of configurations with that energy. And then the other factor is a Boltzmann factor that says low energy configurations are going to be preferable to high energy configurations weighted appropriately by the temperature. So we know the Boltzmann factor, and we know the histogram because we simulated the histogram. And so multiplying these two together then tells us the energetic density of states. Well, it only tells us the density of states over the range of energies that were observed at during the run at that temperature. So, you know, very low energy configurations are unlikely to occur because there are very few of them. Very high energy configurations are unlikely to occur because they're energetically unfavorable. And so at a given temperature, you just get an approximation to the density of states over a certain range of energy. But using these overlapping histograms, we can then achieve a sort of self-consistent reassembly of this density of states to get the density of states over a very broad energy range. And given the density of states, we can then integrate up to get the partition function, whose log is the free energy. And from the free energy by differentiation, you can get any other thermodynamic information you might like internal energy, pressure, and heat capacity, and so on. And so there's a lot that we can do with the results of these simulations. So let me tell you about some of those things. So here is a system of 100 atoms. So it's 48 iron atoms, 6 boron atoms, 15 carbon, etc. And right away you see one of the great strengths of first principle simulation.
Can I just ask you a question?
Yes.
I mean, what you just told us about is all valid in equilibrium.
Yes.
You're now going to apply it in a glass where we have no idea whether it's valid. Is that correct?
So I'm going to apply it to there are various different things that I'm going to apply, and we need to be careful to apply each thing only where it's valid. So for example, the thermodynamics, so my ability to calculate pressure as a function of temperature, that will only be valid if I am in equilibrium in some sense. Well, I'm going to apply it to supercooled liquid silicon. Supercooled liquid, of course, is not an equilibrium, but we can think about a restricted or constrained equilibrium. Let's say that we were to just remove from phase space everything that resembles a crystal, and then we could look at the equilibrium properties of the ensemble that remains, and, you know, presumably that will be what that will be what we describe as a supercooled liquid.
If there's aging or something, then this is complicated.
If there's aging or something, then it's complicated. And so I certainly will not apply those thermodynamic measures to study something like a quenched metallic glass. On the other hand, I will apply the replic exchange molecular dynamics to get a rich set of independent, deeply supercooled liquid structures, each one of which I can then independently quench by conjugate gradient relaxation to get a sample of putative amorphous structures such as this one here.
But what ensemble that corresponds to is tricky.
Well, I'm not doing thermodynamics or statistical mechanics anymore.
It seems like a very nice way to actually age faster by doing.
Yes, and I might mention, by the way, that the replic exchange MD, it's useful for glass forming systems. If you have a system that crystallizes, it's actually no use. So I've done pure copper and pure iron, and they both crystallize using that method, whereas silicon does not crystallize, and this compound also, as far as I can tell, does not crystallize.
The tempering MD compared to Monte Carlo simulations? Could you do Monte Carlo simulations with the ab initio?
You could do Monte Carlo simulations with the ab initio method. Now, there are certain tricks to gain efficiency in molecular dynamics. One is that molecular dynamics, of course, is simulating the natural modes of the system, whereas Monte Carlo, if you're doing independent atomic motion, it might not be doing a very good job of reproducing the true soft modes of the system. then the other point is that since we have analytic variation of atomic positions with respect to time, then there is also a smooth variation of the electronic wave functions with respect to time, and that allows you to predict the wave functions and speed up the convergence of the electronic structure calculation. So molecular dynamics is probably more efficient for first principles methods, but the replica exchange method, that is a Monte Carlo method. I mean, we halt the simulation, do this Monte Carlo step, and then restart the molecular dynamics. So it's kind of hybrid MCMD.
But here you can think of as a way of generating trial configurations.
That's how I think of it, yeah. Yeah. Okay, and I was making the point that this is something that you would never attempt to do with empirical interactions. So let's say that you wanted to create pair potentials for the study of this bulk metallic glass forming system. There are six elements, so it's 6 × 7/2, which is 21. So you would need 21 different pair potentials to describe this system at the level of pair potentials. And by the way, pair potentials are a terrible description for this sort of compound. Okay, so you could never do such a thing with empirical interactions, but you can with the first principles method. So if you want to, you can do it. Okay, now let me show you some of the sorts of information that can be obtained. So one of the first things that I would generally look at are the pair correlation functions. Of course, there are 21 different pair correlation functions. Here I show you 6 of those 21. So these are all of the partials involving carbon and some other element. And so you learn things like carbon-carbon, shown here in black. Well, there are no carbon near neighbors. There are some carbon-boron bonds. But what's most notable are these strong peaks that are especially carbon-chromium, which is the strongest interacting pair in the system, and carbon-iron and carbon-moly. Now it happens, remember that carbon-chromium, well, carbon-6-chromium-23, that was the prototype for the most dangerous metastable phase competing with the metallic glass. And here we see that indeed it is very dangerous. It's the strongest interacting pair, and also carbon iron forms that same metastable structure, and it's possible to incorporate molybdenum into that structure as well. So you see that even in this bulk metallic glass forming compound, this particular C6Cr23 structure will be one of the most important competing crystal phases. And here I've gone back to the enthalpy of formation diagram, but now instead of looking at a binary so that I could plot enthalpy as a function of composition, now we're looking at a ternary. So I've got pure carbon on the lower left, pure, here I'm doing yttrium on the lower right, pure iron at the top. And every point inside the triangle is some particular mixture of these three elements. And over here, diamond structure number 9 is the metastable phase of prototype carbon-6-chromium-23. Here it is appearing in carbon-6-iron-23. And it's metastable with a certain energy above the convex hull, which is given here. It's actually 40 millielectron volts above the convex hull. And then I show what happens if you incorporate yttrium into the structure. So we work hard to figure out where yttrium would like to go if it were present, and find the most optimal sites. And then we look at the enthalpy of formation with one or two yttrium ion atoms in the structure. And we see that the enthalpy of formation rises from 40 millielectron volts to 85 to 138. So the enthalpy rises rapidly as we add a few percent of yttrium to the structure. And the same thing is true for any large atom. Yttrium any of the rare earths. And so here, for example, it was shown with erbium, which is a large atom like yttrium. And in general, it's known that a few percent, like 2%, of any rare earth or yttrium will greatly enhance the glass formability of this bulk metallic glass. And so my claim based on this is that a mechanism for stabilizing the bulk metallic glass is by destabilizing those dangerous competing crystal phases.
So in general, I follow that, but you're comparing, so the 40 to 85 and the 138, that's the difference relative to the convex hull composition?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
One other small detail I might show here. Here is a hypothetical compound, which I calculate to be stable in this ternary. Hypothetical means it's not known experimentally, but the calculations strongly suggest that it should be present. And so that's an example of what I believe to be incompleteness of the experimental phase diagram. You can't always believe what the calculations say. You need to look at how strong the calculated claim is, and how accurate you believe your calculations are. But this is one where I think the calculation is right. There are many disagreements between calculation and observation. About 10 to 20% of specific phases, we find a disagreement between the two. And some of them, the calculation will be right, and others, the experiment will be right.
Just to put things in perspective, there's also a lot of disagreement between one experiment and another. These are notoriously difficult experiments to do properly.
That's absolutely correct.
So there's a lot of disagreement
yes.
there as well.
But presumably, yeah. These borderline cases are ones where you can then try and do finite temperature calculations.
Yes. Now, that one that I showed you was not a borderline case, but there are borderline cases, and their finite temperatures, of course, can lead to great insights. So a typical way that the experimental phase diagram will be wrong is that a phase will form in equilibrium at high temperature, and then the experimentalist will cool it down, and the phase will remain. And they'll say, okay, this phase extends all the way to 0 Kelvin. But of course, they don't know that. All they know is that it was present at high temperature, and there's no obvious instability at low temperature. But the kinetics at low temperature, of course, could be prohibitive. I was going to show a little bit of sort of other analysis that you can do to analyze the chemical bonding and use the chemical bonding to understand some things about mechanical properties and ductility. I won't actually go into any detail on this because I want to skip over to the silicon, but I'll just comment that we're able to find correlations between mechanical properties such as ductility, calculable properties, elastic properties, such as the Poisson ratio, and other calculable properties of bonding, such as this QCA, that's ionic charge. So we can relate the ionicity of the compound to its Poisson ratio and the Poisson ratio to ductility. So you can get some insights that that can be used to engineer your glass forming compounds for particular practical applications.
Can I ask, what's the difference between brittle and very brittle?
The difference is defined in a preprint or a draft that that I'm working on, and this is work done with Joe Poon and collaborators in Virginia, and so it has to do with its behavior under certain kinds of pinch and bending tests and tensile tests, and so they had, you know, certain obscure measures that they use to classify it in one or another.
I mean, we've come to the same sort of classification. We've done an awful lot of work on the calcium classes.
Yes.
And we see an unusual mode of failure in compressive deformation. We call it splitting failure.
I see. In this work, we haven't done compressive deformation, but tensile tests and just picking up a ribbon and bending it, I think is what they did, some of what they did. Yeah.
I'm sorry, the correlations that you show,
yes,
is that something that one can understand, or?
Can you understand it? Well, there are two important correlations there. One is the correlation between Poisson ratio and ductility. And can you understand it? I would say no. There are various hand-waving arguments that suggest that there should be such a connection. And there's a lot of empirical observation to validate the existence of a connection. But no, you cannot understand it. Maybe Jim Langer can understand it, I don't know. No, he can't either. Then the other thing is the connection between ionicity and Poisson ratio. You can kind of understand these things. Ionicity is going to be associated with charge transfer that will also likely lead to, depending where the charges are located, you could have strong angle-dependent bonding, which will tend to decrease the shear modulus and decrease the Poisson ratio.
Can I ask you something for the first part before you end that?
Uh-huh.
These iron alloys are particularly interesting because of magnetic properties.
Yes.
Can you get from your first principle calculations the cool temperature, the magnetic behavior?
Yeah. So one thing you can easily get is the existence or absence of magnetization and the moments on each atom. So you can get that quite well. As far as getting the Curie temperature goes, that's a challenge kind of like looking at the finite temperature phase stability, except that it's harder. And so people are working on that, but I'm not doing it myself.
Yeah. So you said something that, you said a lot of things that confused me.
Okay.
That problem, I think. But one thing in particular, you said that we can understand the relationship between this Q term and Poisson ratio. And you said that it depends on where the charge transfer occurs and it could introduce angle dependent terms.
Yes.
I thought of ionic bonding as a spherical interaction, but you're suggesting that it's not.
Purely ionic case, the classes, they have a Poisson ratio of 0.25.
But that's not from an angular. It's a spherical interaction. But it's not something else.
Yes. This is a map of charge density in a certain plane and a carbon iron crystal structure. And the red are regions of enhanced electron density. And so the carbon is highly electronegative. It draws electrons from the iron, but they don't go spherically around the carbon. They go into molecular orbitals of the carbon.
Yeah, when I think of charge transfer, I think of an electron going from one atom to another. When it gets localized in between atoms, I think of that as a covalent.
This has both ionic and covalent character to it.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah.
So when I think of this kind of thing, I would say that the short-range structure factor would be have very high propensity to have sort of unlike atoms next to each other. And
yes.
Now if I try to shear that, that places a lot of constraints on the shear and makes it more likely to be brittle than ductile, just because it's hard to maintain that short-range order under a shear transformation.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any correlation as well with the short range order structure factor and the ionicity in these things?
I have not quite correlated that. What I have done is looked at G of R. It's easier to get G of R than S of Q. And so in the calcium glass, the calcium aluminum is the extreme of ionicity, and it's also calcium aluminum and calcium copper are also the extremes of high mixed partial pair correlation.
Yeah.
So I think that there is a correlation of the sort you suggest, though I haven't systematized that.
When you measure brittleness and ductility, you actually do an experiment on the computer?
No. So these are done in collaboration with Joe Poon and coworkers at the University of Virginia, who make these things experimentally, and they actually pull on them and bend them.
So the colors are from experiments?
The colors are experiment, and then the data points are calculation. Yeah.
Another question is, for the metallic glasses, there was a long time ago, was from Sydney, Nagel and Tautz, was a rule, somehow a rule that there is a stability of the muted electronic system rather than to the structural system for one phase against the other one, okay, a long time ago.
Yeah. Yes.
Kind of a Van Hove singularity at the Brillouin zone and all that, that changes then the electronic structure. Can you see anything on that in these kind of Q factor over K?
It's
the structure factor was related to the to the wavelengths of the electron, the Bloch waves and so on. That's kind of idea was.
Yeah, I think that those sorts of rules are quite valid in many cases, not always, but in many cases.
We have to measure primarily made by Friedel oscillation.
Friedel oscillation, right.
It
represents
this
KHK.
Yes, right.
Exactly. Yes, that's right. Yeah, and I think actually the calcium-based glasses are probably an arena where that would be especially valid, because these are nearly free electron-like materials. Yeah, and Hofner has actually made pair potentials for probably calcium zinc, maybe one or two of the others. Yeah, and those pair potentials can then be correlated with the glassy structure factor.
Can you tell us how much of the energy in the you're scaling there, how much the electron system contributes to the beginning, and the comparison between, Takeshi was asking, between the glassy structure and the crystalline structure, how much actually the electron system contributes to that? Can you give us numbers? Is that possible?
That's very difficult. What I can do is I can give you numbers for how ionic it is, I can give you numbers for how covalent it is, but as you see from this figure, ionic and covalent actually are not two different things. And then there are other contributions to the energy as well, and there is no rigorous decomposition of the energy into these various pieces. Okay, so let me quickly tell a little bit about supercooled liquid silicon. So one interesting point about silicon is that it's a case where the solid is lower in density than the liquid, just like in the case of water, where frozen water, ice, floats on the surface of liquid water. The same is true of silicon, where the solid density is low compared with the liquid densities. And experimental studies of liquid density suggest there's a possibility of a density maximum in supercooled liquid silicon. So the solid lines are experimental data from various different groups, and the dashed lines are extrapolations of that data, some of which show a turnover and a density maximum in supercooled liquid silicon, again, reminiscent of the behavior of water. And also there's a first principle simulation by Morishita that shows a density maximum. with those analogies in mind between water and silicon, it's worth noting a further analogy proposed by Angel and Shastri, that just as in the case of supercooled liquid water, there's a proposal popularized by Gene Stanley that says there could be two distinct liquid water, supercooled liquid phases. There could be a low density liquid and a high density liquid, the high density liquid water being rather like water that we're familiar with, and the low density liquid water being a liquid, but with other properties more reminiscent of what we would associate with ice. And Angel and Shastri saw similar behavior in the case of supercooled liquid silicon, those studies being done using Stillinger-Weber potentials, and they observed indications of a liquid-liquid phase transition between a low-density liquid structure and a high-density liquid structure. Other groups have carried out simulations using other empirical potentials for silicon, and they get widely different results. So this seems to be a case where the answer is going to depend sensitively on the potential chosen, and so it ought to be an area where first principles calculations could be helpful, because there is no empirical potential to be tuned in that case. By the way, continuing this analogy of water and silicon, so we all have seen pictures of, well, we've all seen ice cubes floating on the top of a glass of water. So I would like to see a picture of silicon cubes floating on the surface of liquid silicon. I actually did manage, with hours spent on Google Images, to find one such picture. It's a really lousy picture, any experimentalist in the room, I would strongly urge you to pursue that as a hobby.
I can tell you what the difficult disease is.
Yes.
It's levitation. When you levitate, there's droplets, okay?
Yes.
There's so much convection, okay? You have a hard time to see anything, okay? It's always.
Yes.
But
to supercool the silicon, you will probably have to levitate it. Yes. Yeah. And that was that picture was a levitated liquid drop, and it was rotating, and something about the rotation told them that that it was solid on liquid.
But aren't there other approaches besides using electromagnetic? You can
go to microgravity.
No. Ken Kelton's done. He'll be here later, I think.
But yes. Yeah. So he's doing electrostatic levitation.
But he does electromagnetic, and there's another approach.
So what? One is magnetic. The other is electric.
They both have convection.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let me just right now jump to my punchline for the supercooled liquid silicon. So these are pressure volume isotherms calculated using the replica exchange molecular dynamics method that I described earlier. So for every configuration, we can calculate its pressure, and then we can reconstruct the pressure using the multiple histogram method. Then plot pressure at a sequence of different volumes. The VASP program that I use for the first principles calculations, it is sadly restricted to constant volume when you are doing molecular dynamics. So we can do studies at many temperatures at one particular volume, and then many temperatures at a different particular volume. And this is the result that you see. And of course, at very low volume, the pressure goes up. And as the volume grows, the pressure goes down. That's ordinary good thermodynamic behavior. If you are at high temperatures, shown here in pink and gray, the pressure as a function of volume remains a monotone decreasing function, as it ought to. If you were to go through a liquid-liquid coexistence region, then the pressure as a function of volume should initially decrease and then level off as you go through the coexistence region. Then once you get to the far side of the coexistence region, it should again continue its progress downwards. Now, I'll tell you more about that momentarily. Another feature I'd like to call to your attention is the thermal expansion. So here we are at a fixed volume, say 17 cubic angstroms per atom. At the low temperature, the pressure is low. At the high temperature, the pressure is high. So that would be associated with ordinary conventional thermal expansion, that the pressure goes up as the temperature goes up, and so at constant pressure, the volume would grow as the temperature goes up. That's thermal expansion. Notice over here, at this high volume, the lowest temperature has the highest pressure, and the highest temperature has the lowest pressure. So in this high volume or low density liquid state that we have over here, we have negative thermal expansion, consistent with what some of those experimental data were suggesting could have happened. So we have positive thermal expansion here and negative thermal expansion there. And that's why these isotherms look so strange to you. You're probably all familiar with, say, isotherms of a van der Waals liquid, where the isotherms nest in each other in a very nice way. Here they are not nesting in such a nice way. And the reason is the opposite thermal expansion on the two sides.
In this case, even the high-density liquid will have density anomalies,
right? So the anomalies are starting around here, yes, and that could be in the high-density liquid. You're right, because these are very high-density liquids, and so around pressure zero, atmospheric pressure, we're already there. Okay, so
this is showing a phase change, right?
And so this is showing a phase change because I described what the isotherms ought to look like. If there was no phase change, it should be a monotone decrease. If there was a phase change, it should be monotone, except it should go horizontal in the coexistence region, if there was a phase change. Now, what are these positive sloped regions? Well, positive slope means that if you start here and increase the volume, then you also increase the pressure. And that's an unstable, explosive situation that violates laws of thermodynamics. And so what you see here, these regions of positive slope, they could not occur in the thermodynamic limit. In equilibrium in the thermodynamic limit. And the fact that they do occur here is a result of the finite size of the system, and it's associated with the energy cost of inserting an interface between two coexisting phases. Mark?
I just want to understand the order in which you did things.
Yes.
But because this is a potentially a glassy state, some of the effects you're talking about could come from the order of states. So if you were to, for instance, start at the, which side are you starting from? Are you starting from the, does that matter?
You shouldn't think that I'm starting here and going there. The truth is that I did all of this at the same time on a multi-processing computer system. Were going at the same time as those runs,
okay,
and they had totally different initial configurations. Now, an important question is, where did the initial configurations come from? And the answer is that they came from very long conventional MD at high temperature, followed by cooling to the temperatures of interest, which are relatively low temperatures. Melting is 1700 Kelvin. High temperature MD followed by slow cooling, followed by extensive tempering to, swap the configurations among different temperatures.
At some particular volume.
That's true for each of these volumes. What I'm describing is true. And then after that long tempering run was done, I threw away all the data and did new tempering runs with those as the initial conditions.
So these all liquid state and no crystalline nuclei.
And so I worked hard to, you know, look for anything resembling crystalline nuclei, and I claim there are not.
These are what system sizes?
These are all 200 atoms. Yeah.
Parallel tempering runs were of order.
So I think that for this data here, I think they were all 10 picoseconds. So I had done from 3 to 5 picoseconds in advance, mm-hmm. threw that away, and then did 10 picoseconds more.
That is actually the main cause for, in this case, it looks like the thermodynamic instability sort of has enough time to rear its head, but the relaxation times in the system are just many, many orders of magnitude higher. Getting the equilibrium behavior, mm-hmm. it's actually not, So for the Stillinger-Weber, we, in this region, mm-hmm. routinely do hundreds of nanosecond runs.
And yeah.
It's not often good enough.
Right.
But the interesting thing seems to be that when there is a phase transition, at least in this case, one seems to be lucky. It's also not guaranteed that it will happen immediately.
Yes.
You do super cooling at zero pressure. Mm-hmm. Very often you can actually go quite a bit into the low density liquid regime without either crystallizing
yes.
or transforming to the low temperature liquid.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
For such a small system, actually, it's very hard to detect the crystallization from the configuration of
right.
ions in your system.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing probably you can do is look at the electronic structure, the density
yes.
distribution. That might suggest to you there are some metallic bonding turns into covalency that may be more sensitive to tell you this
yeah.
may be transient nucleation instead of
right. Yeah, no, that's a danger, and I'll show you shortly that the electronic structure does resemble, in certain sense, the electronic structure of the crystal.
I guess the liquid is metallic, right? And the low density
is called the. You'll see that in a moment. So I just wanted to mention the Maxwell equal area construction that shows what should be the coexisting states. And those coexisting states consist of a high density liquid, which is like the high temperature equilibrium liquid, and then a low density liquid, which is the item under discussion.
Can I just say something about crystallization? Because unless you're going to...
So we haven't seen crystallization, so I can't say too much about it.
Okay. So the point is, when we were doing the runs, when I was doing the earlier set of runs, I worried a lot about crystallization
mm-hmm.
because I wanted to really distinguish the... But it looks like at the end of the, there were sort of worries about because the low temperature liquid structure is so similar to the crystal, will you be able to detect it? Or how can you tell it apart? But the long and short of it is that when crystallization occurs, it's unmistakable. You have sort of finite changes in the energy, and all the measures.
For silicon, the transition is kinetic, it's very sluggish. If you look at the Stillinger-Weber, you have the ionic positions. If you look at that, that's the only information you have.
Mm-hmm.
This is very difficult if you detect the transient nucleation, the embryos of nucleus.
Right.
They may resemble the silicon structure. There's something between the liquid and the crystal structure. That is the difficult part.
Yeah. Well, anyways, let me continue here. So one question, you know, would be, well, what are the structural differences between, say, the high density liquid, which is shown here in this red dashed line, and the low density liquid shown in the blue? So here I've shown structure factors S of Q, and you see that the red and blue curves are very different, as they should be for two distinct phases. You know, you can also look for, well, where are the various peaks that should occur in a crystal? And I unfortunately haven't put them on this plot, but there's no particular match between the liquid structure peaks and the crystal peaks. I mean, crystal peaks are sort of all over with no particular correlation seen to the liquid structure peaks. You can also look at other geometric properties. So we look in particular at Q sub t, the tetrahedral order parameter, which equals 1 when you have perfect tetrahedral bonding, and equals, and it's less than 1 when you do not. And the high density liquid, the high density liquid is this. Well, first of all, the equilibrium liquid shows a peak in the tetrahedral order parameter around 1/2. The high density liquid takes this black curve and sort of evolves it smoothly into this very broad red distribution, which obviously has almost no perfectly tetrahedral bonding. The low density liquid is shown in blue, and you see that the low density liquid has a lot of almost tetrahedral bonding, but very little perfectly tetrahedral bonding. That's just showing the coexistence of the two phases. This is a claim that the low density liquid is not especially crystalline. I've drawn here for you in blue dashed line the paracorrelation function of the low density liquid. The green line labeled CF8, CF8 is the crystal structure, diamond crystal structure, and you see that the G of R of the crystal is just very different from the G of R of the liquid. There are alternate crystal structures that you might worry about. The CI16 is a recovery structure that you get if you take a high density amorphous silicon structure compressed in one of these diamond anvil cells and then relax it, then instead of returning to the diamond structure, you instead reach this CI16 structure, the so-called recovery structure. And the recovery structure is a little bit more like the simulated liquid structure. But on the other hand, there is diffusion going on in the simulated liquid. Jaxi has done a very long ab initio molecular dynamics simulation in this low density liquid and seeing diffusion rates that are orders of magnitude higher than you could expect in a crystalline structure.
Michael, there's also a small peak of zero wave vector in the low density liquid. Is that
down here?
Is that reliable or is that?
No, that's not reliable. I don't know. I don't know just what causes that, but I will comment that getting S of Q from the first principles methods is a real challenge, and so this is that peak is going to be sensitive to how we've done the Fourier transform. Yeah, so that's some kind of artifact. The last
was for which for phases?
The liquid, low density.
High density or the low density? Yes.
So everything here is low density liquid in blue dashed lines, and then the possibly competing crystal phases in the black dashed lines. And again, I would say that it's not strongly resembling any of these crystals.
Okay. high-density liquid near the transition has a very large compressibility, and in principle, it could
So the last slide of data, this shows the electronic density of states, which comes as a sort of a free dividend from the first principles calculations. You get the density of states out. Let's see what's on this slide. So first of all, in green is CF8, the diamond structure. And so you see all these strong Van Hove singularities, and you see the crystalline silicon band gap there. So this is the electronic density of states. And then black and red dashed lines, they look very similar to each other, and those are the high temperature equilibrium liquid and the high density supercooled liquid. So this just confirms that the high density liquid state has sort of evolved from the high temperature equilibrium liquid, and it's very similar in nature. It has a sort of nearly free electron-like character. The nearly free electron behavior is the sort of square root behavior of the density of states. And then you get into the neighborhood of the Fermi level. These vertical dashed lines, by the way, are showing where the Fermi levels are. And you see that there's a reasonably high density of states at the Fermi level, confirming that the equilibrium liquid is a metal, which is true, and the high density supercooled liquid is also predicted to be a metal. And then finally, the blue dashed line shows the low density liquid. And the low density liquid lacks any of the strong singularities in the density of states that you see in the crystal. Of course, those singularities are related to long range crystalline order, which this structure does not have. And then right around where you would see the gap in the density of states for crystalline silicon, you see a very strong depression in the density of states. We would call this a pseudo gap in the density of states. And then the question of what are the electronic properties of this material, it depends on the nature of the wave functions in here, which we just don't know. This density of states that we see for the low density liquid, it resembles what you would see for the low density amorphous silicon, which is a semiconductor. And so it's a semiconductor because although there are states around the Fermi level, those states are localized and don't contribute to the conductivity. We just don't know in this low density liquid, would it be a semi-metal, as the pseudo gap would suggest, or would it be a semiconductor the way that amorphous silicon would be?
So we calculated the electronic structure using the Stillinger-Weber configuration.
Yes.
And we did look at the localization.
Okay.
And what happens is that in the low temperature liquid, the states near the Fermi level get strongly localized.
Yes.
So in fact, if you look at sort of the non-localized states, then you do have a gap.
Yes. So that's what you would call a mobility gap. Yeah. Okay, and so that's the end. Thank you very much.
Mark? Have you looked at things like coordination number and SP3 orientation order and other things in the high and low density?
Yes, we've certainly looked at coordination number. Now, coordination number is,
in the eye of the beholder.
roughly speaking, it goes from 6 to 4. So 6 is the high density liquid, 4 is the low density liquid.
And if you take those and you try to look to see if the angles between them are...
So that's what this tetrahedral order parameter is about.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Could you go back to the image earlier in your talk where you had the isometric view of the iron, boron, carbon, erbium? You had all the different polarities.
Yeah.
We talked a lot during the program here about hard spheres and soft spheres.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, is there any information that you can pull away from your simulations? I see, for example, a pair of iron and chromium that appear to have sort of squished together. Is that a common occurrence?
Yeah, it is. Probably the best insight into that would be, you know, from looking at these things, where, of course, for a true hard sphere, you have a highly asymmetric peak in G of R. I don't know, there's nothing here that strikes me as especially asymmetric. Now, it is true that some of the spheres are softer than others. So erbium, for example, and calcium, these are big, fluffy atoms, whereas carbon and boron tend to be harder in many respects. But all of these are able to, you know, interpenetrate to a certain degree. I mean, there is no such thing as a size of the atom. So even when I say interpenetrate, that means, you know, going within sort of the nominal atomic diameter. Yeah, no.
One of the issues for such a small system calculation is whether or not you distribute the atoms uniformly enough.
Yes.
So that part is tested. You are sure that your system is because you only have 100 atoms, depending on where you put that.
Yes. Well, that's one of the important motivations for using the replica exchange method, so that we get a collection of several different, presumably representative configurations. And yeah, it's especially important with the erbium, where there are only two erbium atoms present. Yeah.
Trying to do silicon using molecular dynamics, we're discovering that with Stillinger Weber type things, that they could get reasonable results for steady state or static properties. But as soon as they started, I'm thinking like Martyr, for example, tried to do simulations and look at fracture, and it just didn't work.
Yeah.
The models were completely wrong. Mm-hmm. What's the 2010 picture of that, and where do you think these techniques are going to go, assuming that computers continue to grow exponentially?
Didn't work.
He tried using the standard thing, and instead of cracking it, it just fell apart.
Yeah. So one comment I'll make is that the phase diagram implied by my results are in absurdly close agreement with Stillinger Weber. I was completely taken aback by that. But I would say there's no reason I can think of why the two should agree so closely. I claim that mine should in principle be somewhat close to reality, although with the caveats of timescale and so on that are concerns. But why it's reproducing Stillinger-Weber so closely, I have no clue. I mean, I have never used the Stillinger-Weber potential, and nothing Stillinger-Weber-ish entered into those calculations.
Is that the simplest old Stillinger-Weber, or there was just sort of the three-body bending?
Yeah, and so the new improved ones don't show this.
There's so many versions.
There are many versions, and I think they show incompatible results.
But there's an issue, right, whether you are capturing the low energy states or whether you're capturing the states involved with bond breaking. And I think that's what people were saying, that a lot of the potentials captured the low energy states.
Yes, but to get the liquid-liquid transition, you need both.
But you're still maybe spending more of your time at low energy states, not just when bonds are becoming unstable. People that try to do reactive fields like Brenner and Harrison find that in general they can't use.
Yeah, but you're going between a covalent bond and a metallic bond. So it just boggles the imagination that it would do it so well.
Well, so what I would say is it's capturing both of those relaxed states.
Both of those two relaxed states, yes. Could be.
But I certainly know Bernstein, who was doing the silicon fracture with Caxeres and Abraham and others. They, as you were saying, they couldn't get good agreement with the brittle versus ductile nature until they went to the electronic structure with all the things that they
tried. I'm not so up on it. So they were able to do better with atomic structure.
When they did the full tight binding, they were able to do well. The last I heard from Noam, which was only a year or two ago, he still was having trouble getting classical potentials to agree with the simulation using tight binding.
Yes, for example, melting. For melting, Stimminger Weber actually does not predict a good melting temperature, right? As we know, and when you have a transition, you have a large rearrangement of configuration, the potential could be off.
I mean, structure is another example, yeah.
So, but I'm not sure in your case, if you are in liquid state or in this homogeneous state, if you do not have large perturbation, you might see a close resemblance. But if you have large change, bond breaking, rearrangement, you might have something.
Mm-hmm.
There.
I think since we're coming back at 12:30.
Yes, probably time for lunch.
We're